waiting for a moment, caught in between 10 and 20, and I'm just dreaming, counting the ways to where you are. I'm 22 for a moment, and she feels better than ever, and we're on fire, making our way back from my. Only got 100 years to live.
How many of you have heard that song before? Okay, wow, a lot of you are as old as me. Yeah, that's a song by Five for Fighting called 100 Years. It was recorded back in 2004, and the first time that I heard it was on a TV commercial. I think it was for like J.P. Morgan or something like that, and there was just a little phrase there, and so I went searching for it, and that's when I found the music video, and that's when it really hit me, the message of this song. Did you notice that in the beginning, there was a teenager sitting there at the piano, and then suddenly there's 39-year-old John Ondrasik, and he just keeps getting older through the song. He's only 15 for a moment, and then he's 22 for a moment, then 33. Then there's a middle-aged man sitting at the piano as you hear the words, "I'm 45 for a moment, chasing the years of my life." And then another blink of an eye, 67 is gone. And finally, there's an old white-haired man playing the piano, and you hear, "I'm 99 for a moment, dying for just another moment." And the chorus that plays throughout the song is 15, "There's never a wish better than this when you only got 100 years to live." That's an optimistic lifespan. But nonetheless, the recognition that our life is like a mist that quickly vanishes is something that all of us who are getting older can relate to more and more the closer we get to the end of our 100 years. None of us knows how many years we're actually going to get, but we all know that it's a finite number. Joseph Bailey wrote a book about death titled "The Last Thing We Talk About." He might not have written it if not for the fact that he had lost 3 sons to death, one at 18 days after surgery, another at the age of 5 from leukemia, and a third at the age of 18 after an accident. Chapter 1 of his book is entitled "The Predictable Event." Joseph Bailey writes this: "Birth and death enclose us in a sort of parenthesis of the present, and the brackets at the beginning and end of life are still impenetrable. Autopsies may become more sophisticated. Cosmetic embalming may take the place of pennies on the eyelids and canvas shrouds. But death continues to confront us with its blank wall. Everything changes. Death is changeless. Dairy farmer and sales executive live in death's shadow, with Nobel Prize winner and prostitute, mother, infant, teen, old man. The hearse stands waiting for the surgeon who transplants a heart, as well as the hopeful recipient, for the funeral director, as well as the corpse he manipulates. Death spares none." It may be the last thing that we do talk about, but it is the most important thing that we can talk about. How can we face the inevitability of our own death with confidence rather than fear, with anticipation instead of dread? That's the question that the 11th chapter of the Gospel of John answers. If you have a Bible, open it up to John chapter 11. And if you don't have a Bible, just open up the White Pine Church app and tap on the Bible icon and it'll be right there. Warren Wiersbe says, "If Jesus Christ can do nothing about death, then whatever else he can do amounts to nothing." Well, this is a passage in which Jesus did something about death. Start reading in verse 1. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Now that word for love that is used there is a particular Greek word that speaks of a special kind of love, and a love that exists between close friends. Apparently, messengers traveled at least a day's journey to relay to Jesus the urgent news that his friend was gravely ill. And when he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Just imagine how encouraging those words must have been to Mary and Martha when that messenger returned to them. Jesus, the one who had healed perfect strangers, promised that he would not forsake his friend. "He's not going to die," Jesus said. Or at least that's what he seemed to say. "This sickness will not end in death." What else could that mean except that he was going to beat the deadline and heal Lazarus before it was too late? And then in verse 5, John reiterates how close Jesus was to this family. He says, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. That's a strange way to show love, isn't it? And what could be more loving than to make a beeline for Bethany? That's what we want God to do when we pray desperate prayers, isn't it? We want him to come now. What better way to demonstrate love than to rush to our aid? But already in this passage, there's an important lesson for us. Jesus' delay in showing up teaches us that God's love for us is not measured by how quickly he answers our prayers. Jesus loved this family deeply, and yet he did not respond to their need immediately. I'm sure there are a lot of you right now that are waiting for God. I'm waiting on God. What are you waiting on him for? And just like I feel this, you feel that the need is urgent, and the wait is agonizing. God seems distant. He seems unresponsive to your plight, and you're disillusioned by it. I just wonder if maybe he brought you here today because he wanted you to see this exact passage and through it to have you hear him whisper, "I haven't forgotten you. I know what you need, and I care. You don't understand my timing right now, but someday you will. So keep trusting me. Know that I love you." We're going to see in this passage that Jesus actually had to delay his response in order to do more than all his friends could ask or imagine. It was 3 long days after Martha and Mary sent word to Jesus about Lazarus' grave condition that he finally said to his disciples in verse 7, "Let us go back to Judea," which is where Bethany was. The problem was that was also where Jerusalem was, just a couple of miles from Jerusalem. And it was in Jerusalem that Jesus had just recently enraged his enemies. In verse 8, the disciples reminded him of that. "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago, the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you're going back?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight?" Essentially, he was reminding them that his ministry was on a divine timetable, that no human could overrule. Evil could not and would not reign until the appointed hour came. And then Jesus continued to talk about light and darkness. He said, "Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." If you wonder why Jesus would state the obvious about physical light and physical darkness, you need to know that this was a favorite metaphor of his. And it almost always had a deeper spiritual meaning. Question is, what is that meaning here? Some say that Jesus was referring to the night and day difference between following him and rejecting him as the light of the world. He is the one who illuminates truth and reality to us. So to try to make sense of life without Jesus is to walk through this world in total darkness. Others think Jesus was hinting that the gift of salvation has an expiration date. It may be the day of our death, or maybe it'll be even sooner than that. Because every time we reject his revelation, every time he comes to us, makes himself obvious to us, and we reject that revelation, the light dims until finally it is extinguished completely. It is always a dangerous thing to delay our decision to follow Jesus. I don't know who's right, but I know that both of those interpretations are rooted in truth. One, in the truth that only Jesus can help us make sense of life and of death and of life after death. And the other is based on the truth that now is the day of salvation and that no one is promised tomorrow. So the book of Hebrews says, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your heart. After he had said this, he went on to tell them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up. His disciples replied, Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better. Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. Actually, the word sleep is used only 4 times in the New Testament to refer to natural sleep, but it's used 14 times as a euphemism for death. To say that someone had fallen asleep was a delicate way of saying that they had died. But Jesus couldn't have meant that, because didn't he say that Lazarus' sickness would not end in death? He did. And yet, verse 14, he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I am glad I was not there so that you may believe. So we know that something's going to happen that is going to help them to believe in Jesus like never before. What is it? Well, he already told them back in verse 11, I'm going there to wake him up. But they had forgotten that by verse 16, because when Jesus said, let us go to him, Thomas, also known as Didymus, and to us as Doubting Thomas, because he was the disciple whose faith required the most evidence, said to the rest of the disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. I mean, he knew it was too late for Jesus to do anything for Lazarus. And he also knew that by following Jesus to that place where his face was on most wanted posters all over town was going to mean that they would likely end up dead too. And yet he said, let's go. So he had little faith, but a lot of loyalty. Verse 17, on his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. And when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him. But Mary stayed at home. Now, if you've ever done character studies on Martha and Mary, you can see how verse 20 reflects their different personalities. I mean, Martha was she was an activist. She was always moving, always initiating. Mary had a gentle and quiet spirit. Martha was a raging river. Mary was a still pond. Even in the way they processed their grief, they were true to type. When they heard that Jesus was coming, Martha, she ran after Jesus. Mary stayed home. She waited for him, but Martha had waited long enough. She got to him well before he got to the village, and what came pouring out of her when she spoke to him was a mixture of grief and anger and hope. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask. Wow, her brother had been dead for 4 days. And she still hadn't given up hope. She couldn't quite bring herself to say, raise him from the dead. But that was the veiled cry of her heart. This is like a trial balloon. And Jesus' response sounded too good to be true. Your brother will rise again. she wondered, could he be saying that? No, but maybe. She answered, I know that he'll rise again in the resurrection, the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Did you hear that? Whoever believes in me will never die. We have a tendency to just skip right past that because in our mind we go, well, obviously everyone dies. But there is a sense in which whoever believes in Jesus won't die. In some way that we cannot understand until we actually experience it, we will escape what we dread. The lights won't go out. Yes, our body will die, but we won't. Woody Allen said, it's not that I'm afraid to die, I just don't want to be there when it happens. And Jesus said, if you believe in me, you won't. Your last heartbeat on earth will be your first heartbeat in heaven. How would your life be different if you knew that you were never going to die? What's actually going to happen? You need not fear that which will not happen. If you believe in Jesus, you will never die. Do you believe this? That's what Jesus asked Martha at the end of verse 26, and it's what he asks every single one of us. And he didn't ask the question to comfort us. He did it to confront us with a choice. Do you believe it or not? Your eternal destiny will be determined by your answer to this question. Do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe that he spoke the truth in this passage? Do you believe that he was and is the Son of God who died for your sins and then rose from the dead himself? Do you believe it? Yes or no? You dare not say, I'll decide later, because you have no idea when the light's going to go out. Martha said, verse 27, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world. And with that answer, she received from Jesus the gift of immortality. At least that's what he promised her. The question is, how can we possibly know for sure on this side of death that he's going to make good on that promise? Well, we can know for sure, not just because of what he said here, but because of what he did next. Watch. Verse 28, after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here, she said, and is asking for you. And when Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. That word that is translated deeply moved usually refers not to grief, but to anger. There was something about what was going on that made Jesus mad. Some suggest that he was angry at the people for their lack of faith, as if their grief exposed unbelief. But grief is not incompatible with faith. It's true, the Apostle Paul told us not to grieve like those who have no hope, but he didn't say don't grieve. Jesus grieved. We're going to see that in just a minute. Now, I think what Jesus was angry about was death, because death was never part of God's plan. I don't care how many times you hear this song about the circle of life, death was never what God intended. Death is the most unnatural thing in life. God created people to live forever. And so that inexpressible pain that we feel when someone that we love dies, and the paralyzing fear that we face as we face the prospect of our own death, that is tragic. It's not the way God planned it. Did you know that every time Jesus encounters a dead person in the Gospels, he brings them back to life? Why? Because he hates death. That's why he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled in this passage. Verse 34, "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. And if you ever wonder if Jesus is mad at you for weeping over separation from a loved one, or if you're ever tempted to think that God is unfeeling or insulated from pain, let verse 35 sink in. It is the shortest verse in the Bible, but one of the most significant. Jesus wept. Did you know that God cries? He does. Isaiah 53 says that Jesus was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. Why did he weep? Theologians speculate, but to the people there, it was as obvious as could be. Verse 36, "Then the Jews said, 'See how he loved him.'" Jesus wept because his friend had died. He knows what that feels like. That's why even now he mourns with those who mourn. It's because he understands the ache of separation from a loved one. Some who saw Jesus weeping shook their heads in wonder at his compassion, but others shook their heads in confusion about his non-intervention. Verse 37, "But some of them said, 'Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?' They thought, 'Why did he wait? Now it's too late.'" But they were wrong. Verse 38, "Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance." "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," Martha, the sister of the dead man, said, "by this time there is a bad odor." King James says, "He stinketh, for he has been there 4 days. Wait a minute. Hadn't she asked Jesus to bring her brother back to life? Yes. Hadn't he promised to do so? Yes. But can you blame her for doubting? And she watched her brother die. She was there when he stopped breathing. She saw his skin color change. She felt his body go cold. She helped wrap it in burial cloths. She saw it being placed in the tomb. It was 4 days ago. The body is starting to decompose. That will test your faith. But then Jesus said, verse 40, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." Notice, his purpose in praying out loud was to help those who were there to link what he was about to do with who he claimed to be. Verse 43, "When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come out.'" The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. And Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." He did it. He raised his friend from the dead. Why did he do it? He did it so that unbelievers might become believers, and so that believers might start believing what they believe. that their life, like Lazarus's life, will not end in death. See, we don't have to just hope for that. We can bank on it, not just because of what Jesus said, but also because of what he did. Think about it. Who better to trust for accurate information about life after death than the only person who has ever brought the dead back to life? Imagine being there. John was. This isn't a story that he made up. It's a historical event that he recorded. And it had its intended impact upon some. Verse 45, therefore many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. Let's look at that on the next slide if we can. Yeah, so they believed in him, many of them. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Whether they went as informants or to ask their religious leaders for permission to believe in Jesus, John doesn't tell us, but what they said created such a stir that verse 47, the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin, that is the Jewish Supreme Court. What are we accomplishing, they asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. It's common for non-Christians to say that their biggest obstacle to faith is the lack of evidence. But obviously, that wasn't the problem here. It was undeniable that Jesus had just raised a man from the dead. No, the reason they opposed Jesus instead of believing in him was because he threatened their way of life. I mean, if he got too popular, the Roman government might take notice. They might try to stomp out the Jewish religion. They might even take away what was left of Israel's independence. And where would that leave them? Without the most enviable job in Israel. These men lived in the lap of luxury. They had power and prestige and wealth. So whether it was to protect their nation or their religion or their jobs, the price tag for faith in Jesus was just too high. The issue was not, what's the truth? The issue for them was, what's the cost? Many people reject Jesus not on the basis of truth, but on the basis of cost. For some, the social cost is too high. They've got a reputation to protect. To become a follower of Jesus might change the way that their friends, their family, their coworkers think about them. Might even threaten their job. And even though they recognize the voice of Jesus as the voice of truth, they plug their ears and betray their heart because the cost is just too high. For others, there's a moral cost that they don't want to pay. There's something they're doing that they know they'll have to stop doing if they start to follow Jesus. And that would leave a gaping hole in their life. Even though Jesus said that he came to give us life in all its fullness, they cannot imagine how a full life could exclude that habit, that relationship, that addiction, that secret. And it just comes down to the fact that they want their sin more than they want a Savior. The cost is just too high. And for others, it's their religious heritage they're afraid to violate. They come from a Jewish family, from a Muslim family, from an atheist family. And maybe other family members have said that anyone who becomes a follower of Jesus will bring shame to the family and will violate their precious heritage and will break their mother's heart. And so instead of going where the evidence leads, they choose family over faith. The cost is just too high. It's fine to evaluate Jesus on the basis of cost, as long as you figure into the equation the reality of eternity. If the evidence leads to the conclusion that eternal life is real, then this earthly life of ours is just a dot on that endless timeline. And it compels us to ask the question, would I rather pay a high price on the dot for prioritizing the line or pay a high price on the line for prioritizing the dot? Which is the wiser trade-off? The members of the Sanhedrin were so blind to eternity and so consumed with this life that they would not allow anything to rock their boat. Not even a resurrection. Verse 49, then one of them named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up, probably to those who had the guts to say out loud that maybe it's not very smart to oppose a man who raises people from the dead. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. If Jesus doesn't die, he said, we will. He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. Essentially, what the high priest did unknowingly was to preach the gospel, the good news that Jesus was going to die for us, in our place, as our substitute. All have sinned, and the wages of sin is death. And so Christ died once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. And whoever believes in him will never die. That's the gospel. That's the secret of immortality. It's the fountain of youth. It's how to be 15 forever. Verse 53, so from that day on, they plotted to take his life, unaware that they were the villains in the story of how God allowed one man to die for all people so that those who believe in him will never die. So what's the takeaway from John 11? Well, it all depends on where you stand with Jesus. If you're a Christian, what God wants to do with this passage is to transplant the truth that you are going to live forever from your head to your heart. He doesn't want you just to know it. He wants you to live as if it's true, because it is. Several years ago, there was a 17-year-old boy in the church that I was pastoring that was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And despite our desperate pleas to God, he didn't get healed. In the end, he was in a hospital bed at home with his family gathered around. And when I got the call that he had died, I went right over. And the look I saw on his parents' face was like nothing I'd ever seen before. It was like this holy mixture of grief and hope, even joy. They were weeping, but also rejoicing. They described to me their son's last moments. His breathing slowed, and he closed his eyes, and they thought he was gone, but then suddenly he opened his eyes and smiled and said, you'd all like it here. And then he closed them again, and that was it. He died. He stepped out of his body into heaven. And when we buried him, we declared that one day Jesus is going to come back and raise that very body from the grave, whole, healthy, immortal. That boy did not get 100 years. He got eternity. He's 15 forever. And so are we. If you're not yet a Christian, the question for you is very simple. Why not? Is it because of a lack of evidence? Or is it really about the price tag? As you're thinking about what it will cost you to believe, don't forget to ask yourself what it will cost you not to believe. You have a choice to make. Are you going to live for the dot, or are you going to live for the line? The day will come when your body will die. The question is, will that day be for you the end of life or its beginning? The answer depends completely on what you do with Jesus.